Gold. That's what we like to do on this show. Find the comedy gold.
I just like non-fungible as a word.
It is a good word.
It's a wonderful, it just has a good mouth feel.
La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time, this is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Madinaire. And our next guest we could not be more excited to talk to. Dan Kaufman is the author of the book, The Fall of Wisconsin, an outstanding, deeply researched account of the era of conservatism that started when Scott Walker got elected. And it was published in 2018. And he's also written for The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, The New York Review of Books. And most recently, he had two different pieces about our Supreme Court race in The New Yorker. And we're so excited for him to be here. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you, Kristen. It's really a pleasure and an honor. I've heard so many great things about the show and what I've heard of. I mean, when I've caught it, it's been great. So I really appreciate it.
Well, that's always fun to hear.
We love unsolicited praise, Dan. Thank you so much.
Well, and I told you this is an email, but I'm going to say it on air. So I was living in Brooklyn. So when I left, I was working in tech. And I when I Donald Trump got elected, I, like so many people, got very, I got awakened and got back into politics. And so mostly when I first started creating content that was like political comedy, it was on national topics. And I came across your book, and I think it was more specifically in the New York Times talking about, it was like kind of the summary of the book at first, of what had happened to my home state. Because at that point, I hadn't lived in Wisconsin since 2003. And I wasn't really following the politics. I knew when Act 10 happened and the protests and everything. But in reading your book, it really opened my eyes and kind of planted the seed of what had happened in Wisconsin. And I made a video at my what I was then called Below the Fold about it. And, you know, 2 years, not even a year later, I was back in Wisconsin, and I don't think there would be an As Goes Wisconsin had that book not put Wisconsin back on my radar. So thank you. I mean, I'm not sure everyone would thank you. There's a couple people who maybe wish I would have never moved back. But yeah, I will say thank you, because it was really eye-opening. And do you look back, think, I mean, it's 5 years, and sometimes that can feel like an eternity, but like, that was a monumental book.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think the book has had a kind of enduring appeal, even though, as you say, it came out in 2018. I did do a new afterword for the paperback in 2019, which was right after I was kind of taking into account Walker's defeat. I think it has. One thing that I found maybe most moving about the book is, like, for me, the heroes and heroines of the story are really the ordinary Wisconsinites that kept persisting and trying to reclaim the state that they had known and that I had known growing up there in the 70s and 80s. People like Chris Taylor, people like Lori Compass, Randy Bryce, Mike Wiggins. And I think, like, while initially it seemed like they were defeated, I never felt as though they were ever really defeated, partly because they always kept persisting. And I think they kept alive, and maybe the book was useful, I think, in reminding people of what the state had been, not just for Wisconsinites, but really for the entire country. It was such an important tradition that really was founded in the upper Midwest. Minnesota has some of it as well, but I really feel like Wisconsin was sort of this model and embodiment of a sort of a very communitarian outlook, a progressivism that was also rooted in pragmatism, that was really about uplifting ordinary citizens from across the entire state, not just favoring urban citizens or rural ones. It was really quite remarkable. And I think that still endured, you know, up until Walker. And he was really hellbent. And the right was hellbent on really uprooting it entirely. In fact, you probably remember, or maybe not, but there was an effort to remove the Wisconsin idea legislatively, the actual, you know, and I think that was really sort of, you know, sort of representative of how deep they wanted to overturn this tradition. And I just felt like these people, these ordinary citizens who were facing defeat after defeat, Randy Bryce during the right to work fight and Lori in her fight to defeat Scott Fitzgerald in a heavily gerrymandered district, and Chris Taylor kind of following Alec around trying to expose what it was doing to the state. They were really important. And while sometimes, you know, I'm reminded of, I think it's a Bob Dylan line, but I think he took it from the Bible, like the loser now shall be later to win. And I always kind of thought, as long as these people keep resisting and keep that spirit alive of trying to hold on to it, that eventually things would turn around. And then they have remarkably on some levels. I mean, I also, and we can talk about this, have some, I think there's certain structural things that are in place that make it very difficult to make sort of deep changes. And it's also, you know, in some ways the state has become, you know, some of what was very special about it has been lost. And by that I mean a tradition of clean, transparent elections and government, where you had people spending very small amounts of money. As I say in the piece about the Supreme Court election, you know, 20 years ago, the outside spending in that race when Pat Rogensack first won was $27,000. And now, you know, it was $45 million. And I don't really see that. And I think, you know, there are a lot of progressives like Matt Rothschild and people like that that are troubled by it. And I understand that, because I feel like, in some senses, the right was the first to nationalize the state's politics. And in a sense, the left or center left and progressives have caught up to that. But there was something very unique about our tradition that is in danger, I think. And that, you know, is maybe a cost of pushing back against this right wing onslaught. But I think it's also important to note it, you know. So
we're talking to Dan Kaufman, who's the author of the book The Fall of Wisconsin, and many other pieces as far as in New York Times and New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker. So do you feel like it's challenged, that tradition is challenged or lost?
Challenged. Okay. I think there's so many people that remember it and admire it and that are aware that they have to. People like Anne Walsh Bradley, who's an excellent, she's a Supreme Court justice now, as you probably know, and she will be up for re-election in 2 years. It will be interesting to see what she has to do. She was very deeply rooted. She knows this history very well, Wisconsin's progressive history, and is deeply rooted in it. And in fact, she told me, you know, and up to a certain point, Supreme Court races were nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she insisted when she first ran in 1995 that she wanted, she had former Governor Tony Earle, a Democrat, as her campaign chair. And then co-campaign chair was Sue Ann Thompson, who was Tommy Thompson's wife. And she wanted to distance herself. And now she understands that that's no longer possible. Yeah. And I'm not sure it ever was. The courts have always been politicized. But there was, you know, I think this nonpartisan tradition comes out of Bob La Follette and where he was very suspicious of partisan influence on state agencies like the DNR and the civil service. And they wanted it to be very clean and transparent and to work for the public. Absolutely. It was a civic tradition that was very important. And I think a lot of people still remember it and still admire it. And still, unfortunately, money since Citizens United in particular is just a profound reality in our state. And also the Republicans gutted the state's campaign finance laws in 2015. And now you can donate. An individual can donate $20,000 to a Supreme Court candidate. That's like six times more than what you can donate to a presidential candidate. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. So So anyway, those are just some thoughts I have. I don't know if
it's just so interesting because I mean you've done so much research and it wasn't like you just like clapped your hands or like oh I wrote the book. Like you're still writing, you're still here, you're still coming back a lot to talk about it. So it's so interesting to hear your point of view as far as especially the having it be steeped in history of like sometimes those of us who don't study history or have short memories forget. And I think that was what was so eye-opening to me when I first found your book was the like Bob La Follette and like also just the tradition of Wisconsin being for better or for worse the canary in the coal mine. And like you outlined so much of the progressive policies of the early 20th century that Wisconsin was the laboratory of democracy for that got adopted across the country. But then also McCarthyism and also the Scott Walker being the pre-Trump Trump. And and then Tony Evers being the moderate white guy ahead of the moderate white guy we put in the presidential office, right? Like there's this thing, and it's kind of why I named it As Goes Wisconsin, is there's you can find the pattern of Wisconsin kind of being ahead of the curve of where the country is going. Do you feel like that is true?
Yeah, I do. And I think that some of the progressive victories might auger in a wider, or might be reflective of a wider trend. It's very important what's happened in Wisconsin and the pushing back against the far right. And also you see some of the fissures on the right when the Stop the Steal movement, I wrote a big piece about that and this this sort of dancing between the so-called kind of establishment Republicans and the really the ones that embraced fully like Tim Ramthin and others that embraced this and I think there's tension there too. Going back to Evers for a second,
we got to go to a break so don't forget what you're going to say. So we're going to go to break. We'll come back with that. But then I also want to talk about the end, the Scott Walker line of like, if we can do it here, we can do it anywhere. And was it success? I don't know. I'm going to get your opinion on it. We're talking to Dan Kaufman. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
Ass over tea kettle and you think you're done? No, you got to keep her moving.
When it all goes to hell, I need my head right. I go to where there ain't no stop and go lights. But I got no desire for the 5-star resort.
Got a cousin with a cabin way up north.
When it's cold in the winter, I drink beer and treat.
You are listening to As Goes Wisconsin, a product of Civic Media. Enjoy it live across Wisconsin, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Find your local station on our website, civicmedia.us, or on the Civic Media app, and catch any of your favorite shows as a podcast wherever you listen.
Any other state, Wisconsin embodied the idea that states might become laboratories of democracy. Fast forward to today, and instead of a laboratory of democracy, Wisconsin has become a laboratory of right-wing, anti-organized labor politics. Wisconsin literally became a testing ground for the Koch brothers in how to remake American politics. During the Tea Party wave in 2010, the Kochs and other outside conservative donors spent millions of dollars to elect a massive wave of Wisconsin Republicans, including Scott Walker. And those Republicans remade Wisconsin politics. Quickly. Scott Walker and co. ruined Wisconsin's labor rights, environmental protections, voting rights, government transparency, the Packers' 8-year playoff streak, and my enjoyment of last season's Bachelorette because of Jason T's strong resemblance to a certain Wisconsin governor. And what's been the after effect? By 2018, Wisconsin experienced one of the largest declines of the middle class of any state in the country.
I use Scott Walker as the picture.
I know.
In that video. There's a lot of, it's basically, Dan, there was a lot in there that was from your book, riddled with like John Oliver type ridiculous jokes. Like, I think I have something about Christopher Robin in the 100 Acre Woods. But we're talking to Dan Kaufman, who is the author of The Fall of Wisconsin and many other pieces about Wisconsin and other works. So we were talking about Evers, and we were talking about how Wisconsin is kind of arguably the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the country. And so I want to let you finish that thought.
Oh, I was just going to say that although Governor Evers does, you know, present as a moderate and so on, you know, in talking to him, and I wrote a couple pieces about him before I was elected, he is really kind of deeply versed in that Wisconsin tradition, just like Anne Walsh Bradley. And he was also at some of the Act 10 protests. And I think his background in the public school system, I think, connects him to this tradition, which, again, it's hard to describe, but one of the tenets of it was that a very strong support for public institutions, the university system, and public education. And I think in that regard, he maybe, I wouldn't call him a radical, but he's more connected to that Wisconsin progressive tradition than maybe is so obviously apparent in the way that he presents himself and so on. It's just to say that I was surprised slightly that he had participated in the Act 10 protest when I first interviewed him. But then in retrospect, it made perfect sense because that was such a broad-based movement. And I think it's important to understand that it wasn't just people from Madison at all. It was people from all over the state. And they were outraged because the schools are so, there is this really strong feeling, and not just the schools, but public workers, the public sector is very, very important because of this earlier tradition. And I think he, as well as Janet Protasiewicz, she was also a member of a union when she was a state prosecutor, and she also participated in the Act 10 protests. And I think that was kind of like this incubator. Again, even though it failed, it still, it echoed out, not only for Wisconsin, but Occupy happened, Occupy Wall Street happened a few months later. And it also, you know, it was the beginning of, in my opinion, of a revival of interest and passion for the labor movement generally among young people. You see it all over the country. I really think that what happened in Wisconsin, because there had not been a labor uprising in decades in the United States like that, that was very important, even though it was defeated. So anyway, those are just some thoughts about Tony Evers and the importance of the Act 10 protests for where we're at now in the state, you know.
Absolutely. So. Well, and it's interesting because I did not read Scott Walker's memoir, but you did.
And what was it? Unintimidated?
I don't know.
Unintimidated,
there
right.
There you go.
Right,
good job,
right,
Jane. Right, is it sitting on your bookshelf? Right. But one of the things, because of your reading your stuff, I knew that he had put in his book, if we can change Wisconsin, we can change anywhere. Sure. And it was the juxtaposition of how the tradition and the progressivism in Wisconsin, and when him and his Koch brother allies set out to change things, they did. And for the better part of 10 to 13 years, they have.
Right.
And so I guess in light of this past election and in following and reporting on so many of the people who never stopped fighting despite Act 10 falling, and have continued to run even when they knew that they were going to lose, and all of the work that kind of culminated into April, do you think that's still a true statement that he put in his book? If we can do it here, we can do it anywhere.
I mean, I think it's a very true statement because it's somewhat happened. I mean, even in Florida, just the other day, there was a big Act 10 like law against the public sector unions that DeSantis signed. There's still this anti-labor just acceptance. I don't think, you know, and as much as I think the labor movement has revived, at least people's appreciation of it, it's never pulled higher. It's at the lowest point it's been ever since, I think, probably since the 20s, since definitely before the Great Depression. It's about 10% of the entire population. Wisconsin is at barely 7%, half of what it was. So that's what I mean. It's like there's definitely the possibility for a reclamation of this tradition, but these structural changes, they're very hard to undo. Yeah. In Michigan, they just, it was the first time they've overturned they repealed the right to work law, but at the same time, they've lost a lot of union memberships. The weakening of labor, it's very hard to bring it back. And while there's some attention to it, you know, it's an open question whether it's enough and what will happen. Like, if they were able to repeal Act 10, that would be a major change, and it would be very significant. At the same time, you know, a lot's been lost, and it's, you have to be honest, you know, things are really in a very precarious state. And I think that one of the themes of my book is how important the destruction of labor was to Trump's election. Mm-hmm. And basically, you're going to have Trump versus Biden again. And I think he saw an opening, the hollowing out, not just in Wisconsin, but the entire Rust Belt, was very important to his victory, you know, and that was fueled a lot by free trade agreements that were supported by the Clintons and others. And, you know, and those jobs are, it's very difficult, you know, because it's been so hollowed out to recreate it. You need a massive public investment, something like a Green New Deal. And Dan, whether or not that happened.
We're going to run up to a break, but this was so wonderful. We'll have to have you back. I will link your Twitter, all your books and all your pieces in our show notes today, but this was so interesting. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
It was really a pleasure.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
Okay.
All right. When we come back, how do you react when you don't understand something? This is As Goes Wisconsin. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin. This is Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair. What music are we listening to?
That is Land of Confusion.
By?
Disturbed.
Oh.
Not the Genesis cut. I took the one from Disturbed.
I love this for you.
I do.
I love your music choices and the rationale in your brain of like, this is why I'm going to put the song here.
Makes sense to me.
And that's all that matters, Jane.
Thank you.
All right. This is an existential, self-reflective question for you. For you, Jane, for you listening. How do you react when you don't understand something? And I'll give you three choices. Do you look at the thing you don't understand, acknowledge, I don't get it, and go on with your day? Do you look at something you don't understand, maybe have an adverse reaction at first, but then try to learn more about it? Or three, do you look at something you don't understand and does it anger you? Because largely, I don't know if there's another choice. And they're big kind of sweeping buckets.
Right.
But when you, and I say don't understand, I don't mean like calculus. I mean...
A piece of art, a film.
A piece of art, film, a lifestyle choice, opinions, religious, like how religious someone is or isn't. When you look at something and you say, I just don't get it, do you not think about it again? Do you try to figure it out? Or do you let it get under your skin and really anger you? And I bring this up because, this is why we can't get rid of TikTok. But
so much content.
So much content. So much just average, normal people putting thoughts that are make you think on the internet. There's a lot of garbage out there, but then there's something like this. So this was yesterday. I was waiting for something and I found this TikTok from a guy who lives in Minnesota. And I love it because you can hear his Midwest accent come through a little bit. And we'll break it up a little bit, but I'll let him set up this experience that he had.
I was just at the Minnesota Museum of American Art, and I was just chilling on this bench in front of this new art exhibit, and I'm just watching as people walk by, watching their reactions. And this one guy walks by with his girlfriend, and he looks up and he audibly says, that is like the strangest thing I've ever seen. I don't get it. And then he just keeps moving. Like, he didn't perseverate, he just moved on, right?
So that's option one. When you don't understand something, I don't get it, move on.
This older man walks by. I'm watching his facial expression as he turns toward this exhibit. He was so perplexed, like even more perplexed than the first guy. He was like, what is this? He walks toward the exhibit and he starts to read that little stand in front of the exhibit that kind of explains who the artist was and what the message behind the art is. He stands there for like 5 minutes just reading this information. He had to have read it several times. And he looks up at the exhibit again and he looks like he is in awe. His reaction just completely shifted after reading a little bit about it. And he was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I get it. And then he left and he moved on. It was so beautiful.
So that's option number two.
Yep.
Don't get it. Read more.
Learn
ask
about
more
it.
Questions. Learn about it. Are you that person?
Or are you this one?
Okay, now it gets good. This other guy comes up with one of his friends, and they're like, what the f*** is this dude? Laughing, making fun of the exhibit, whatever, and I'm just sitting there like, oh my God, Lord help me. And suddenly, I see him spit on the exhibit. And of course I say something, and I can't just let that happen. I go, what are you doing? That is not respectful. And he goes, f*** you. And then he walks away. A couple minutes later, he comes back. I'm like, oh great, he's back to kick my ass. No, he's back at the exhibit. He looks at it again. Looks just as disgusted as he was before. And he starts to kick the exhibit. And I'm like looking around like, is anyone else seeing this? Like, what do I do? He takes things off the exhibit and starts to throw it. Completely destroy it. I see security guards down the hall. No one comes. No one does anything. They just let him continue to destroy somebody's art because he doesn't get it. Finally, the guards come up and they pull him off and he's screaming and shouting, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. This shouldn't be allowed here. I hate this. It's stupid. I don't get it. And I'm like, what the f-? So I leave.
Thanks for bleeping those out. So that's the third option. And this is probably the harder one to admit as far as if you have that reaction of when you don't understand something and you get angry and you want to destroy that thing. Are you that person? And then he makes the
rep. I've never seen anything like this before. And then I realize I see this every single day. There are people who don't understand something and they just leave it at that, right? They don't let their lack of understanding affect the lives of other people. They just move on. Then there are people like the second guy who do not understand something at first, and rather than run away from it, they're willing to sit with it for a little bit, read about it, to see if there's something in it that they can understand, that they can open their mind to. And then there are other people who, when they don't understand something, not only do they not care to learn about it, but they will do everything in their power to tear that thing apart, and they will keep beating that thing down until it no longer exists. Because if they don't understand something, they don't want it around, right? Because they have so much hatred bottled up inside of them. Who are you? Which one are you?
844-967-2789. Which one are you? Which one do you, when you are confronted with something you don't understand?
And this is applicable to all of us.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just one political party versus another political party.
No, and it's not just controversial issues. It's, like we said, this was an art exhibit. And now it makes me want to go look up what the art exhibit potentially was, because he never talks what it says what it is.
Right.
And just shout out to the creator of that, Robbie's Moon Music. He's a guy in Minnesota. And I kind of love that he doesn't go into what the exhibit is, because it doesn't actually matter in the story, because then you're justifying or not justifying each person's behavior in this specific instance. But this metaphor can be used for art. It can be used for lifestyle. It can be used for religion. It can be used for almost anything. Yep. Of our own biases, our own blind spots, and what you do when you're confronted with something that you don't understand, and where do you fall? And it's probably depending on what it is. It may be different reactions to different things.
Sure.
But I'm interested if this sparks anything for you, how do you react when you don't understand something? 844-967-2789. That's 844-96-PARTY. And I want to believe, and I think largely, I am curious enough that when I don't understand something, I do try to dig deeper. It's why I'm trying to get more and more conservatives on the show. And I try to understand as much as sometimes I want to make a joke first, but I would say my instinct is more to understand than to be right. For me, some people on the other side of a fight with me may not agree, but I think that's how I see myself. Or I think I'm the first guy.
It just doesn't bother.
It just doesn't bother me. And that unless it affects my life, I just go on with my day. I don't think beyond, I think the only time I'm the third person is if I feel like there is deep bigotry, prejudice, harassment involved. Like, I think my tolerance for trying to understand is much lower when there's actual, like, racism, sexism, and also like malintent.
Right.
Then I would say I just don't get it and want you to go away. Where do you think you fall?
I think I have to own all three of them.
Okay.
You know, there are certainly cases where I don't get it. It doesn't matter. It's not going to affect my life. I'll let it go. Certainly there are instances where I don't get it. I want to find out more about why I don't get it. You know, just natural curiosity, I think, sometimes. And then the third one, there are just some things. I don't believe that anything is black and white. I think that's impossible.
Yeah.
And so that's where my frustration comes in with everything is this way or it's that way. Because I don't believe that.
You don't subscribe to binary thinking.
No, I don't. There's too much gray in everything. And there are nuances to everything and special circumstances for so many things.
So you're saying you get to the point of being angry when you don't understand people who are binary thinkers?
Yeah. Like it's this way, you know, it's my way or the highway. How do you even
function?
Well, how do you argue with that? How do you even try and reason with that? It's a dead end.
Yeah.
It's a dead end.
Well, and it's interesting because I think it's interesting that he uses this, the example is an art piece, because I don't think I've seen art necessarily, like how much art can, but I guess you think about statues.
Lots of controversial art pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. And to the point where it gets under people's skin so much, but I know the reason he posted this, because it was in a reaction to Dylan Mulvaney, who I think now, a couple of weeks ago, I'm not sure if we said that name on this station or this show. I think there's probably a lot of people who would have been like, who?
Yeah.
But now, just for context, Dylan Mulvaney is the trans influencer who is at the heart of all of the Bud Light backlash.
Hoo-ha.
Yes. And I think that's a perfect example of people having a very outsized reaction to something that they don't understand. And there's probably people out there who think they do understand Bud Light, but like, to me, we haven't talked about that, the whole scenario on the show. To me, she was a weird choice from the get-go for Bud Light. Like,
she doesn't look like a beer drinker.
She doesn't come off like a beer drinker.
No.
But how angry people have been in reaction to it versus it's a beer company. Like, who cares? And so I haven't talked about it because I largely kind of think, like, I keep expecting it to blow over, but it doesn't necessarily seem like it is. And more of the interest of, like, when and what do you not understand that causes such an emotional reaction, whether it's Bud Light, whether it's an art piece, and maybe to a certain extent we're all guilty of it and we're not always good at admitting it. But I do think that in one way or another, you typically fall into one of these three buckets when confronted with something you just don't get.
Well, and I think what is outsized in that third option, again, with, you know, having these angry, is the amount of violence and dehumanization against things and or people which you do not understand. And if they don't affect your life, I don't understand that level of vitriol. It's unhealthy.
Well, and it's, yeah, I don't know if there's anything that I have crusaded against that doesn't, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, like I said, I think when it comes to like bigotry, being where I stand in the world as a white, tall, thin, pretty privileged. Like I hit the lottery in a lot of ways as far as how I move throughout the world. And so some of this stuff, one could argue, doesn't necessarily affect me when you talk about racism and fat phobia and a lot of stuff. But like,
because misogyny certainly does.
Misogyny certainly does. But you know, so stuff that when you talk about stuff that doesn't affect you, you still care about it. I would say that's kind of where I fall, of still being like, well, it's still my responsibility to care about these things. But I don't know. What say you? 844-967-2789.
Texter from the 920 says, sadly, I think people's reptile brains are becoming more dominant as a whole. And I'm assuming that he's talking about, again, these extreme reactions where you're just blinded by rage and anger and hatred.
Our tribal lizard brains.
Yeah.
Of just first animal instinct
right.
is to
fight,
attack what we don't get. Yeah, there's an argument for that. But would love to hear from you on this topic, 844-96-PARTY. We'll take a break and be back in just a second. This is As Goes Wisconsin. To As Goes Wisconsin, I am Kristen Bry. She is Jane Matinair. And speaking of things we don't understand.
This is a good one.
And this is a good reaction. I mean, this is a good example. I did not necessarily, when all of this was happening, I had an eye roll reaction, but I didn't necessarily have a super angry reaction to this. But breaking news from earlier, like an hour ago, and actually, our friend Joe McClear.
Thanks, Joe.
Put it in the Facebook live stream. But breaking news, Wisconsin Supreme Court in a 6-1 ruling rules that a hospital can't be forced to give deworming drug ivermectin, popular with conservatives, to COVID patients. The only justice to dissent, Jessica Rebecca Bradley.
No ivermectin. You cannot force a hospital to give an animal dewormer medication to humans.
So this is from the AP. Wisconsin's conservative-controlled Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that a hospital could not be forced to give deworming drug to a patient with COVID-19. The panel ruled 6-1 in favor of Aurora Healthcare, with three liberals and three conservatives in support, and only conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley dissenting. The decision upholds a lower court's ruling against Alan Gall, who sued Aurora in October 2021 when doctors refused to treat his uncle, John Zingsheim, with ivermectin. Gall was authorized to make medical decisions for Zingsheim and had researched the drug online after he was put on a ventilator to treat COVID-19 complications. And so there you have it. Hospitals cannot be forced to administer that drug to you.
This is a good thing, which I do not get. And in my previous iteration, I talked to veterinarians. I talked to biologists. I talked to the Poison Control Center when ingesting bleach was suggested, to do stories about whether or not these treatments would work. And ivermectin does not work. It's a different organism than a virus. Ivermectin treats something else than a virus. And I appreciate people doing their own research. I think it's great that people are looking for more information. But if you're talking to someone from the Poison Control Center who's telling you not to ingest bleach, why would you not believe them? If you're talking to a veterinarian who says, this drug is not intended for human beings, I've been doing this for most of my life, trust me, this isn't going to work, you're going to find some Franklin Jr., somebody on the web somewhere who says, no, I tried it, it's great, also drink urine.
But I think this is a perfect example of one thing that if we're relating this back to the topic in this previous segment, and if you're just joining us, in the previous segment, we played a video of a great, it was an actual thing that happened to this guy in Minnesota, but it also just serves as a great metaphor for the three kind of typical reactions someone can have when they don't understand something. To acknowledge it, I don't get it, move on with your life.
Right.
To say, I don't get it, and look into it more. Three, to say, I don't get it, and be angered by that.
And I have to get rid of it.
And I have to get rid of it. And I would say the ivermectin thing, as this popped up, I think I fell into, I don't get it. Most of the places that I trust and the things that I believe in are saying, are making fun of it, and this is silly. But I never ended up going and like researching it more, because I have heard that there are, it's not just a horse dewormer. Like I have heard there are, and especially in different countries, there is uses for it.
Different applications.
For humans. But everything I have heard as far as its efficacy against COVID has been not so much. But like I would say, I would be the first one to admit, it's not like I've read a bunch of scientific studies to go do my own research. I've kind of just like lazily assumed that the sources I typically go to that have not verified any of this, the people who want to believe that it's true say it doesn't actually work. And like that's kind of where I have fallen, instead of being more curious and being like, well, maybe I should try to understand this since I don't get it on its face. But I certainly don't get it.
Well, and I only did it in the context of my job.
Yeah.
Because I was concerned that people were going to harm themselves by ingesting things that aren't good for you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this is a good ruling. And I'm kind of surprised it was 6-1. I am.
And so, it'd be interesting to see what, because this isn't a, you know, the Supreme Court's not there to say whether or not the drug is effective.
No.
Like I'll have to read more about it maybe at the break to see what laws that this is where the Supreme Court fell as far as what you can
force a hospital
to do when it comes to administering different available prescriptions and treatments. But it is settled. And it's also, it doesn't happen very often, a 6-1
No, it doesn't. They agreed on something. Oh, that's just crazy.
It is. It does bring up a different conversation as far as how miserable Rebecca Bradley's life's going to be come August.
When Janet Curtis-Sewitz is
inaugurated. I think she's not going to like her job as much anymore, to say the least. All right. Well, when we come back, did you know that May is National Foster Care Month, or Foster Care Aware? National Foster Care Month, and it's meant to honor foster parents and families and all the dedicated people who support children through their journey to find compassionate, stable homes. And so, in that vein, in the celebration of National Foster Care Month, Oriana Carey is going to be here. She is the Chief Executive Officer of the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families, which provides resources and support through every stage of a family's foster care, kinship, or adoption experience. And so when she's here, we're going to talk about the difference between those three things, adoption, foster, and kinship. We'll talk about some of the misconceptions and myths about foster kids, about fostering. We'll talk about kind of the state of where Wisconsin is and even the nation is when it comes to the need of foster kids. So if you have questions about this, we would love to hear from you. 844-967-2789. That's 844-96-PARTY. We will talk to Oriana Carey from the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families when we come back. But now we got the top of the hour news. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
The
Thank you for listening to As Goes Wisconsin, available on Spotify, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe and leave us a rating. As Goes Wisconsin is a product of Civic Media and airs live across Wisconsin Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Civic Media is a statewide network of radio stations broadcasting local news, local sports, thoughtful commentary, and hand-picked music. We are always streaming on the Civic Media app. Find out where you can listen on the air or learn more about Civic Media and sponsorship opportunities by going to our website, civicmedia.us. We thank you for listening.